This podcast may contain explicit language.
Welcome to the Greatest Movie of All Time podcast, the show that uses a unique grading style to redefine what the greatest movies are. I'm Tom Duncan.
And I'm Dana Duncan.
Tonight, for our 203rd episode, we discuss the romantic comedy and Best Picture winner from 1934 with It Happened One Night, celebrating its 90th anniversary a few weeks ago. Directed by Frank Capra, written by Robert Riskin, music by Howard Jackson and Louis Silvers, starring Clark Gable as Peter Warren, Claudette Colbert as Ellen Ellie Andrews, Walter Connolly as Alexander Andrews, Roscoe Carnes as Oscar Shapley, Jameson Thomas as King Wesley, Alan Hale as Danker, Arthur Hoyt as Zeke, Blanche Federici as Zeke's wife, great character name, Charles C. Wilson as Joe Gordon. Recognition for this movie, It Happened One Night, was originally released on February 22nd, 1934, making this its 90th anniversary this year. After filming was done, Colbert complained to a friend, "I just finished the worst picture in the world." Columbia appeared to have low expectations for the film and did not mount much of an advertising campaign for it. Even so, many critics of the time lauded the film, particularly for its two-star leads. And despite the positive reviews, the film was only moderately successful in its initial run. After it was released to secondary movie houses, ticket sales became brisk, especially in smaller towns where the film's characters and simple romance struck a chord with moviegoers who were not surrounded by luxury, and it turned out to be a major box office smash, making $2.5 million worldwide on a budget of $325,000. The film would go on to win all five of the Academy Awards for which it was nominated at the 7th Academy Awards for 1934. Best Picture, Director for Frank Capra, Actor for Clark Gable, Actress for Claudette Colbert, and Adapted Screenplay for Riskin. It has since been known only to be one of the three films to win the so-called Big Five at the Oscars, along with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in 1975 and The Silence of the Lambs in 1991. Although I might add that even though it didn't have a Best Actor win last year, we had a Best Supporting Actor, Best Supporting Actress, Best Actress Directors, technically, with a plural, Best Original Screenplay and Best Picture for Everything Everywhere All at Once. So maybe that's the modern version of the Big Five, is a Big Six, basically a huge sweep across the major categories. It Happened One Night has since had several remake versions as well as adaptations into other cultures, including many Indian film versions. The AFI, the American Film Institute, has also recognized the film on the following lists. 1998 for AFI's 100 Years, 100 Movies at number 35. In 2000 for AFI's 100 Years, 100 Laughs at number 8. In 2002, AFI's 100 Years, 100 Passions at number 38. For AFI's 2005 list of 100 Years, 100 Movie Quotes, the nominated Ellie Andrews, "Well, I proved once and for all that the limb is mightier than the thumb." It made 2007's 100 Years, 100 Movies 10th Anniversary Edition at number 46, and the 10 Top 10 in 2008 under Romantic Comedy, where it placed number 3. In 1993, it was selected for preservation in the U.S. National Film Registry by the Library of Congress. It Happened One Night currently holds a 98% among critics on Rotten Tomatoes, an 87 score on Metacritic, and a 4.1 out of 5 on Letterboxd. So as we start each week, Dad, what is your relationship to this movie?
I have none.
Oh, really? This was your first time?
Never have seen it.
I didn't know that.
Nope. Had seen clips, but that's it.
Interesting. So this is one that I'm glad I shared with you. This falls under the similar category of The Third Man. These are some of these older films that I saw either in my progression through the AFI Top 100 list, both the 1998 and the 10th anniversary in 2007, or Best Picture winners that I've completed. And I know I've mentioned many, many times, and people are probably very tired of me saying that I've completed those lists. But either way, This was one that kind of jumped out to me, much like the Lost Weekend of Best Picture winners that went unheralded. I also really love A Man for All Seasons as a film that not a lot of people talk about necessarily, or that doesn't make the rounds, but it's in certain groups. And it's a very charming, it's a very cute movie. I think Clark Gable is exceptional in this film. And it's another example of a Capra movie when he hits the sweet spot of the sentimentality that he's known for so well, where it really works and it's not too overwrought with sweetness.
Well, yeah, I agree. Part of the charm of this film, I mean, this was 1934, height of the Depression, and it's one of the things that probably struck a chord with the common man in the country was the fact that it almost made the filthy rich look buffoonish.
It is similar to his other Best Picture winner in You Can't Take It With You, in that regard, that it's kind of making a commentary on those in power, those with wealth, and that you supposedly can get by on much less if you have other values. And I do think, given the time period, the context with which, or the historical context at least, that you're mentioning, I would imagine that given that it took until its second round, again, this was a film that didn't do well in its initial release, but as it kind of got word of mouth, went into smaller areas, and the values play of this film, this would be a what we would call a heartland type movie, as opposed to a coastal elite in these days, let's say, if this were to be 2024, as opposed to 1934.
Well, it's still to some extent that. I mean, this is a film that's going to play well in Topeka, Kansas, Springfield, Illinois, Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, West Bend, Indiana, and not do as well in Los Angeles, New York, Miami, even now.
Well, maybe Miami, yes. I don't know if I would go so far out on a limb as to say, like, people in New York or Los Angeles wouldn't appreciate it now due to its legacy, but it just, maybe at the time, wasn't as big in the urban centers as it was in all of these other places like Cincinnati, Ohio.
Sure.
Or Cheyenne, Wyoming. Just to throw out something completely random. Anyway, so what is the movie actually about?
I guess ultimately it's about one person's generosity. It's one person's willingness to be giving and to put himself above somebody else, just to help, and in the process develops a bond with somebody who cannot understand initially his generosity, his willingness to be kind without expecting something in return. And that relationship ultimately results in her falling in love with him when she realizes that he is this way, and he falling in love with her as he's taking care of her. It's really about expectations and sacrifice.
This doesn't invent the romantic comedy in any way. Obviously, the romantic comedy stems back to, I would say, Shakespeare at minimum. But it's the classic meet-cute where two people from completely different circumstances find kinship in each other, and when they realize they want the same values in life. It's kind of a equalizing film. So we just got done with the Oscars preview last week where we talked about a similar film, I would say, in The Holdovers. It has a different ending, obviously, because you have two people of different generations trying to connect over similar values. But I think you have a similar play in that. And it becomes kind of the prototype for most romantic comedies after this. I mean, whether you're talking about An Affair to Remember or you're talking about Harry Met Sally, all of them in some capacity are based on kind of a Pride and Prejudice give and tug. One person can't see past the end of their nose. The other person can only see this other person as something else. And thus, that's the core of the movie. And it's really supposed to be at a human level. We all want the same things out of life. We all want to be loved. We want to be respected. We want to share our lives and make them meaningful through that sharing of it with another person. It just happens that they meet in this kind of unusual circumstance, and despite being from different backgrounds, come to have a fondness for each other.
I guess the word I'm looking for is magnanimous. I mean, she's never had experience that. She's expecting everybody to try to use her because of her wealth and power. And that's, she can't understand him at that early part. So it's really about, in part, two people talking in two different languages. He's talking about being, about protecting and helping and whatever. And she can't understand how anybody would do that without expectation of compensation.
But he is. That's the thing. Like, that doesn't turn into him. He's not chivalrous till near the end when he no longer wants anything from her. His own anger and heartbreak turn him into, I guess, the chivalrous equivalent of what she was actually looking for. And she falls for him before that anyway. But he is using her, or they are using each other. He has enough street smarts to get her where she needs to go so that she can end up in the relationship she wants to be in. He's using her for the story so that he can get his job back.
Well, yes and no, because he did a lot of things that were above and beyond that, like chasing down the luggage and getting rid of the I don't know what you would even call him, the creep on the bus.
How about his character name, Shapely?
Shapely. Okay. I mean, those things were not required for him to get the story.
The luggage was before he technically realized who she was, because she had not yet been identified. So yes, some of that was just human decency and kindness. And yet she still assumed that he was doing something incorrectly, or where he would want something in return. The Shapely point of view. And again, if you're going to take the cynical side of this, he was looking to expose that, and he was looking to divide the money. So yes, again, this is for his own gain, trying to get rid of the guy. I don't see that as necessarily chivalrous. It's only to the point where he realizes, I have affection for this person, and then has his heart broken, that he gives up on a reward or any real money, and somewhat in spite, only insists on, what is it, $39.60 or whatever?
Yeah.
So I just don't find it quite as magnanimous, to borrow your word, as maybe you're trying to give this overview of, again, from the cynical point of view.
Okay, fine. I guess, you know, if you want to, I have a little bit more. I'm not quite as cynical. Let's put it that way.
I think you have to have the cynical aspect to it, though, to present the challenge or the barriers that they have to overcome. Because if it's just two people interacting and then they're like, oh, well, I like you, it's not as interesting. It's not as entertaining. You don't have the as big of a cathartic moment where they find, oh, yeah, I actually have affection for this person. So it's just more of an example of, I would say, good storytelling as opposed to the other way around.
I understand your points. I just don't necessarily agree. So that's fine.
Should more people know about this movie?
Yes, but it's an 80-year-old movie. And trying to get people to watch films from 25 years ago is hard enough, that are in color, that they've heard of. It would be nice. I taught you and your sisters that music didn't start in 1990. There are older things. Movies didn't start with The Lion King. And I've tried to introduce you to various genres of music and of film, but not everybody does that.
No, I think film started roughly in, what was it, 1895, 1897, somewhere in there, with the man on a horse?
Edison.
I'm not sure that was Edison. I know Edison's credited with the invention of film, but I don't know if that specifically, that we can trace back as the first full motion picture, was his creation. It could be. I just, maybe I'm misremembering it. I don't know.
Okay.
even so, there are films beyond the talking picture and beyond the color picture.
Yeah.
And further back than The Godfather or Star Wars.
Do you need to explain those?
I don't feel the need right now. Although, okay. Can I really mansplain to another man?
We have an audience.
That's true. But based on the demographics I've had, I think it's predominantly a male audience.
Well, yeah, okay.
Just saying. That's what the numbers supposedly say.
Okay.
Most of our listening audience, from my recollection, unless they're like community friends of ours, look a lot like you.
Okay.
Based on a lot of the movies we've chosen.
I see.
That's why I think Rio Bravo continues to be one of our highest downloaded, highest commented on, highest viewed YouTube episodes.
Old guys like quality.
Is it Capra's best movie?
It might be. If it isn't, it's really close.
I think he has a very easy to figure out top four. And then you could start throwing in Mr. Deeds, where I think he won another Best Director. You could throw in Arsenic and Old Lace. You might be able to do a Meet John Doe or Lost Horizon, depending on your mileage. But I think that the top four for the most would probably be his two Best Picture winners, this one and You Can't Take It With You, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington from 39, and It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes.
So I think if you were to ask most people, because they're more familiar with it, It's a Wonderful Life is probably his most famous film, and thus most people would probably put that one number one. But having seen this now, I guess, how would you relate the two?
This is a little more intelligent. I think It's a Wonderful Life is more designed to be syrupy. I mean, if you're in a real sentimental mood, I might put It's a Wonderful Life ahead, you know, around Christmas. But for the rest of the year, this probably is ahead. And that's one of my biggest, you know, what my drawback was as to whether it is or it isn't. I think some of it depends on the time of the year. And right around election time, I like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington because you like to believe that there are people who have some scruples and morals who end up in Washington.
I got to say, the more times that I've watched the Ides of March or House of Cards or any of these like political machination operator type films, TV shows, etc., Mr. Smith Goes to Washington just becomes less and less realistic. It feels from a completely different era in a way that even this, while it is clearly made in the era in which it debuted, it doesn't feel quite as set in that era. That picture for me just feels almost stationary. And maybe it's just because I'm too close to it being a former political operative for the first part of my career, but that'll be one we address soon.
Okay.
I think we have it on later this year. Pretty sure we do. And I think Sarah might be making one of her returns for that one since she's been off for like 2 years.
Okay.
So let's give some more background on the movie. Do you have our plot summary ready for us?
Yes. It Happened One Night is a classic romantic comedy film directed by Frank Capra and starring Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert. The story follows Ellie Andrews, a wealthy heiress, who runs away from her controlling father to elope with her lover. On a bus journey to New York, she meets Peter Warren, a recently fired newspaper reporter. Initially, they clash, but as they travel together, they develop a begrudging respect and eventually fall in love. Along the way, they encounter various obstacles and misadventures, including hitchhiking, sleeping in hay, masquerading as a married couple to evade capture. Ultimately, Ellie realizes her love for Peter and decides to pursue a life with him instead of her wealthy upbringing. The film is celebrated for its witty dialogue, charming performances, and endearing depiction of love blossoming between two unlikely companions.
Thank you. Did you know? In 1935, after her Academy Award nomination, Colbert decided not to attend the ceremony since she felt she would not win, and planned to take a cross-country railroad trip. After she was named the winner, studio chief Harry Cohn sent someone to drag her off the train, which had not yet departed, to take her to the ceremony. Colbert arrived wearing a two-piece traveling suit, which she had had the Paramount Pictures costume designer Travis Banton make for her trip. Just to explain, because I think there may be a incompatibility, they did not announce the winners in the 30s at the award ceremony. They just allowed you to accept your award at the award ceremony. Most of it, because it was controlled by the studios at the time, was released in the trade publications like a couple of days ahead of the actual award ceremony. And ironically, who did away with that? But eventual Academy president Frank Capra. Did you know? Clark Gable gave the Oscar he won for his performance in this movie to a child who admired it, telling him it was the winning of the statue that had mattered, not owning it. The child returned the Oscar to the Gable family after Clark's death. Did you know? On December 15, 1996, Gable's Oscar was auctioned off to Steven Spielberg for $607,500, who donated the statuette to the Motion Picture Academy. In June of 1997, Colbert's Oscar was offered for auction by Christie's, but attracted no bids.
I wonder if there was a minimum bid on it.
That would be my guess, because otherwise somebody's, hey, I can get an Oscar, I can bid a dollar, like an eBay thing.
Yeah.
Did you know? While shooting the scene where he undresses, Clark Gable had trouble removing his undershirt while keeping his humorous flow going and took too long. As a result, the undershirt was abandoned altogether. An urban legend follows that it then became cool not to wear an undershirt, which supposedly resulted in a large drop in undershirt sales around the country. Legend also has it that in response, some underwear manufacturers tried to sue Columbia Pictures. Did you know? The unpublished memoirs of animator Friz Freleng mentioned that this was one of his favorite films. It Happened One Night has a few interesting parallels with, and may have even inspired, certain characteristics of the cartoon character Bugs Bunny, who made his first appearance 6 years later and who Freleng helped develop. In the film, a minor character, Oscar Shapley, continually calls the character of Gable Doc. An imaginary character named Bugs Dooley is mentioned once in order to frighten Shapley. And there is also a scene in which Gable eats carrots while talking quickly with his mouth full, as Bugs often does. Did you know? Clark Gable was loaned to this film by MGM as punishment for his affair with Joan Crawford. Some punishment.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a good spot for our first break, and we'll be right back. Before we jump back into the episode, next week for our 204th episode, we discuss The Diary of Anne Frank from 1959, celebrating its 65th anniversary. Directed by George Stevens, written by Francis Goodrich and Albert Hackett, starring Millie Perkins, Joseph Schildkraut, Richard Boehmer, and Shelley Winters. You won't want to miss that one, so watch ahead of the show by searching the Real Good app to find where it's streaming for you. That's R-E-E-L-G-O-O-D. We left off at Best Performance, Dad. Who do you have down?
I have Frank Capra.
As do I.
The pacing, the design, the overall, his contribution to the script created an environment for everybody in the film to excel.
I think that his creation of the environment, and you can definitely tell with his cinematic touch on it, the sweetness that I kind of talked about, the sentimentality that is so apparent in many of his movies, that this level of earnestness is what was needed, but he also kept it somewhat restrained. Whereas I think Mr. Smith is a little bit over sentimental in its depiction of political morality. This to me doesn't age quite as much because I feel there is some level of restraint in comparison to a couple of his other more famous films. And so with that, I give him a good job for balancing this out and creating kind of an underground hit as a result of it. because I don't think the film would work if it were just any other director. It would have been something that would have been relegated to the dustbin of history a long time ago had it not been solely for him. Not to saying that there aren't additionally important people in this, but I think he is the central figure that makes this movie go.
Who do you have for secondary?
I have Robert Riskin. I actually, even though there were some criticisms at the time of the narrative overall, think this is actually a fairly well-written, kind of very simple script that you solved your meet cute problem. You put them in enough situations of a road travel movie, and it's kind of a combination of a road travel buddy film with a romantic comedy on top of it. So I actually think that the script writing, the overall story itself, while it's not great for its dialogue, works effectively for a movie this old.
I had Clark Gable. I thought his performance was outstanding. I had only seen him in a few films. Mutiny on the Bounty. I'm trying to remember, other than Gone with the Wind, which other ones. But I never understood what his appeal was until I saw this movie and saw kind of a whimsical side to him that wasn't always in many of his films.
No, I think that comparative to the more dashing Rhett Butler type that is supposed to be the prototype of what it is to be a man of the 30s, the dashing rogue-scallion type, this is a much more accessible character. And that's why I have him as most charismatic, because I think he is central to how this movie has to be accessible to its eventual audience. You have to be willing to be able to place yourself in the shoes of him, that maybe you're not a journalist, but you could be kind of down to earth. You'd be okay with slightly embarrassing yourself, but not to the extent where you really feel that you have a loss of identity or status. And you could still get the girl in the end who's the heiress. It's kind of an inverted princess story in that way. I know that if we had Mom on, she would try and make this into something like that, because she does that with every romantic comedy we discuss with her, or at least it seems that way. But I think it's more inverted in that capacity, because he's a guy who just got fired. He's a drunkard. He's not particularly good at handling money, but he's better than she is, at least at roughing it. And so he can make do with things, and just being him somehow becomes endearing.
And I also have him for most charismatic. A lot of the same reasons that I liked his performance and a lot of the comments you made. I mean, it's just something about him, his quality, that was endearing that I guess I never had seen in other films. So I'm kind of curious to watch some more of his films. He had that period during World War II where he was out of film because he actually served as a side gunner on a B-17. One of the few in Hollywood who actually appeared in combat.
Did we want to discuss at all Claudette Colbert as the fourth kind of primary person in this? It's the only one neither of us nominated for anything.
I mean, we could. I didn't think that much of her performance. She was okay, but I don't know. I didn't think that she was that believable as the snooty brat, nor did I believe she was that believable as the woman scorned.
I too don't find her particularly believable. I find her to be overly dramatic in a kind of 1930s acting kind of way.
acting.
A particularly early 1930s kind of acting, overacting portion of things. The only time I really felt that she was really believable is when she was trying to ask Peter if he'd ever been in love, and then kind of confesses her own feelings to him. That was about the only time that I really bought into her character. I don't think she detracts necessarily from the film, but if you had put, what would have been a great actress of the time? I guess I'm not as familiar with 1930s actresses as I probably should be, but like if that was Teresa Wright, it's a much, much better film than it even is. Like, we're talking, it might be like an all-time classic. And I think it is at least in a conversation of all-time classics. But, like, it goes up even a further level if you get an actress of, like, full quality in it.
I can buy that.
All right, let's go to best scene then. I only have six down. I have Ellie gets robbed. I have missing the bus. I have the walls of Jericho. I have Peter ditches Shapley. And then I have New York when they're kind of like sideswiping past each other after the confession. And then the eventual wedding kind of as the climax. Did you have any to add?
How did you account for the hitchhiking? Was that is the escape to New York?
I completely left it out.
Well, I would add it.
Okay.
Because that's my most indelible moment.
Is that also your best scene?
No, actually, no, that is not. My best scene is the walls of Jericho. It's a classic scene. It's well known. It's famous. People make references to it without having any idea the source from where it came. The whole idea of, you know, well, we're going to hang a sheet or a bed spread across a rope and divide the room. Or, you know, I mean, did you do that as kids?
Only for like creating blanket forts.
Oh, no, we would do that like when we were on vacation and we were sick of each other. I'd hang up a blanket and say, you stay on your side and I'll stay on mine.
Well, how many of those have a rope across the middle of the room like that?
No, but you could do it with pillows on the bed. You could do it with, you know, where you like mark it with like clothes. You go, this is my line, side of the line. This is your side of the line. Yeah.
I mean, I have that as my most indelible moment from the film because I think it's iconic from the undershirt moment to kind of them interacting for the first time at night. I think, especially because it has so many callbacks, they do it a second time and then the third time to end the film, that if you've seen the film, it's kind of recognizable. I understand that the hitchhiking has like a particular moment to it, but for me, this is a little bit more iconic. But the best scene of the movie, to me, where I think it starts to break down kind of the sappiness that we'd started to steer into, especially after the love confession, is him going to New York. Then them missing each other, then her going to New York, then, yeah. So when it kind of breaks down and he eventually has this revelation with his boss at the newspaper and you kind of see things start to unravel and you get the final act of the movie, I think is where this actually picks up another gear. So for me, that's the best moment or the best scene of the movie.
Okay. My favorite scene is missing the bus.
Okay.
It's the one I have not given. And for me, it reminds me of so many times where I've made warnings to people and to you kids and such about be careful, etc. And it was comical to me. Again, she was so used to if she didn't want to do something or whatever, people just stopped and waited for her, just stopping and catering to her whims that she had no idea how normal people acted and how people reacted to normal people.
For me, it's Peter ditches Shapley because when he gets into the situation, you think for sure they're going to have, or he's going to have to cut him in. There's no way out of that. And yet he thinks of a great, clever plan in the moment that gets rid of the guy and figures out exactly what to do with him so that you get this creep off of your back and you have no, I don't know. I'm just impressed by the ingenuity in that moment.
It was creative.
So we both also gave our most indelible moment already. So I believe that takes us to our second commercial break. We will be right back. Before we jump back into the episode and before we get to the Stanley rubric in a minute, if you're ever curious about our Master Greatest Movies of All Time list that has every graded movie we've ever discussed on the show, there's a link in the episode description of every episode of this show, or you can go to ronnieduncanstudios.com/gmotepodcast and find it as the top entry on the Greatest Movie of All Time podcast show page. That has the grades we've done so far for all 188 movies we've graded, and we continue to add more each week. Make sure to check that out as we go and follow along. Also, you can follow each individual episode on our website as well. That has the notes for each individual episode with all of our scores, category nominations, and the individual factoids for each episode of the show. Just click the link in the episode description of this episode or go to ronnieduncanstudios.com/gmotepodcast to find that. Dad, do we have anyone to remember this week?
Yes. Janice Burgess, 72, American television writer, producer, and executive. The Backyardigans, Winx Club, and Blue's Clues.
Now, all of her obituaries credited her as being the inventor or creator of Backyardigans. I think she was just a contributor to the other two.
Okay. Betty Brodel, 104, American actress. Swing Hostess, Too Young to Know, and Cinderella Jones.
The note I saw on her, even though most of her career was musicals in the early 30s, I believe, was that she was the oldest living actress yet until she passed away.
Wow. Julie Lynn Charlotte, 101, American actress and fashion designer, inventor of the poodle skirt.
Which obviously has sentimentality for the Duncan family. So if you are listening, Allison or Sarah.
Mark Dodson, 64, American voice actor. Gremlins, Return of the Jedi, and Day of the Dead. Charles Durkup, 87, American actor. Policewoman, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and The Sting. And I found when I was looking through, and I thought I would understood who this actor was, he was originally from La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Oh, really? Okay. I missed that.
Yes, graduated from Aquinas.
Okay. Interesting.
Kenneth Mitchell, 49, Canadian actor. Jericho, Star Trek, Discovery, Miracle, and Captain Marvel. Buddy Duress, 38, American actor. Good Time, Heaven Knows What, Person to Person. Jackie Laurie, 93, American actress. The D.I., Judge Roy Bean, and beauty pageant title holder as Miss USA in 1952.
And she has a small other connection to the Duncan family. She was Jack Webb's third wife.
Oh. Okay. Chris Gauthier, 48, Canadian actor, Smallville, Eureka, and Once Upon a Time.
Which was one of Allison's favorite TV shows.
Chris Mortensen, 72, NFL reporter and journalist. Eddie Driscoll, 60, American actor. The Last Ship, had various TV credits on Sex and the City, Mad Men, Entourage, and This Is Us.
And so we remember all these here for their contributions to the arts with a moment of silence in their honor. Thank you. Let's move to best funniest lines. I only have three, so this may be short, but Alexander Andrews, I asked you a simple question. Do you love her? Peter Warren, yes, but don't hold it against me. I'm a little screwy myself.
Peter makes a couple of bids from the hay off of a haystack. Peter, all right, come on. Your bed's all ready. Ellie, I'll get my clothes all wrinkled. Peter, well then take them off. Ellie, what? Peter, all right, don't take them off. Do whatever you please, but shut up about it.
Ellie, aren't you going to give me a little credit? Peter, what for? Ellie, I proved once and for all that the limb is mightier than the thumb. Peter, why didn't you take off all your clothes? You could have stopped 40 cars. Ellie, well, ooh, I'll remember that when we need 40 cars.
Ellie, you think I'm a fool and a spoiled brat. Well, perhaps I am, although I don't see how I can be. People who are spoiled are accustomed to having their own way. I never have. On the contrary, I've always been told what to do and how to do it and when and with whom. Would you believe it? This is the first time I've ever been alone with a man. Yeah? It's a wonder I'm not panic-stricken. You're doing all right. Thanks, nurses, governesses, chaperones, even bodyguards. Oh, it's been a lot of fun.
Peter Warren, I want to see what love looks like when it's triumphant. I haven't had a good laugh in a week.
Peter, you know, I had you pegged right from the jump. Just a spoiled brat of a rich father. The only way you get anything is to buy it, isn't it? You're in a jam, and all you can think of is your money. It never fails, does it? You hear the word humility? No, you wouldn't. I guess it would never occur to you to just say, please, mister, I'm in trouble. Will you help me? No, that would bring you down off your high horse for a minute. Well, let me tell you something. Maybe I'll take a load off your mind. You don't have to worry about me. I'm not interested in your money or your problem. You, King Wesley, your father, you're a whole all lot of hooey to me.
I'm out.
And so am I.
All right, let's go to the Stanley rubric then. Legacy is up first. Do you want to go first or second?
Go ahead.
I would be tempted to give this a 5, if not for the simple fact that I don't think that, even though it's held in high esteem, it's not on that top tier. When you start talking about critics and Hollywood people, this is not in the first 10 movies they're going to talk about of classic Hollywood. They're going to go to Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz and Casablanca a lot faster than they're going to go to this movie. Even It's a Wonderful Life is probably going to get mentioned by most people just due to its recognition of tie-in with Christmas and how many people have seen it comparative to this one. So I have it at a 4.5. Now, on the audience side of things, we did our informal poll, and I was not shocked in the slightest. There were 4 people, and all of them were at least over age 45. I'm not sure how old some of the staff members are, and I don't want to do them a disservice, particularly because at least one of the people that raised their hands listens to this episode. So if you're younger than 45, and I have mistakenly placed you in a older category, I apologize. But I would say that this is a movie that, if you've heard of it, you're probably of an older age category, or you're a film nerd like myself. There are just not a lot of people who know of this movie. You'd never seen it, and you're a film nerd like myself. This would have been probably something that I think your dad would have loved. So I'm kind of surprised that there isn't a little bit more of a connection. So it's a 1 for me. So I have a 5.5.
All right. Legacy. I think you're a little high on the industry side, simply because even though it's on all the lists and everybody talks about how great of a film this is, you never hear anybody mention it. You know, when they're putting together lists or they're talking about the best films. When you talk about Frank Capra, this is maybe the 4th film people mention, I think, as some of his other films get mentioned well before this. So I gave it a 3.5. I gave it a higher mark simply because it did create a legacy. I think it really made the situation comedy bankable. I think it even propelled Clark Gable's star higher than it already had been. But again, then going to the public, I went with a 1.5 simply because, again, it's had multiple remakes. Some of the scenes have been recreated, such as the hitchhiking scene. How many times has that been done in other movies? So I went with a 1.5, so I'm at a 5.
On the industry side of it, to make a further argument of this, given its place earlier on in the history of Hollywood, how influential it kind of was in developing, I would say, somewhat of the screwball comedy before the screwball comedy became a thing. You have, additionally, this made Clark Gable in his early career. Like, he was a player, but he wasn't the star. And I know we haven't mentioned it before, but I think, and I've tried to figure this out, I don't know how many leading men have, or just lead actors, period, have appeared in 3 Best Picture winners, let alone 3 Best Picture winners within the span of like 6 or 7 years. Frank Capra was crowned as like the toast of Hollywood with this at this point, and he became the IT director for a while. He became the president of the Academy as a result of it. He wins 3 Best Directors in the decade and was at one point the record holder for that until passed by John Ford, with, I think, The Quiet Man in 52 was his 4th one. There's just a little bit of extra added stuff that we're talking about. And if it really did influence the Bugs Bunny cartoons, that has outlived its importance much later on. So if I'm going to make the argument for why 4.5, yes, it's not necessarily the first thing people mention, but I don't think it's without its influence and without people that have placed it in high esteem, given the amount of lists and other things that it did at least fall on for something like the AFI or the National Film Registry. I do think there are people that recognize its importance, even if it's kind of lost some of its sheen, which is why I went down that half step, but maybe not as far as you.
Okay. I will go up a half step on the industry and give it a 5.5. Do you need help with the math on that?
Oh, if you could so ever grace me with your ability to do your math on your abacus there.
Are you Blanche DuBois or Scarlett O'Hara?
Does it matter?
Well, they were the same actress, but okay. Sure. 5.5?
I believe you're correct. Impact and significance. In the moment this is released, while not universally praised by the critics, and I think there is a little bit of the sheen off in the initial viewing, again, with the quote-unquote coastal elite, the only thing that I would have it down from a full 10 in its moment is, one, that it's not on the level of some bigger films, but this was the biggest performing Columbia Pictures film until like the 1970s, 1980s, if you adjust for inflation. So it was a huge hit, and I think people came around on that. So this was the equivalent of what I would say was like the Titanic of its day, where it was a huge crowd pleaser. It was the common everyman film, and it ended up sweeping all of the awards at the same time. So because of that, I have a 4.5 for the industry. I have a 5 for the audience. I have a 9.5.
I went with a perfect 10. It won all the major awards. The industry loved it.
No, I think the industry reluctantly accepted it. I don't think that it was universally loved, which is, again, just a little bit of a nitpick.
Okay. I can't make that nitpick, so I'm going to stay with my 10.
So that's a 9.75 average between the two of us. Novelty. This isn't particularly novel. We've compared it to many things of the romantic comedy. I would say that it's ahead of a few other ones that we've discussed on the show, particularly Howard Hawks films like Bringing Up Baby and His Girl Friday. And it's enough of the precursor with the early 30s coming out of silent pictures that you could give it a little bit of credit for that. I will go about a 3.5 in its actual ability to be novel or creative or original, given that it is very much a story of its time, trying to tell a meet cute between two people of completely different classes in an era where the classes were so broadly divided, given the socioeconomics of what was going on. But to me, where this movie is really great is in its execution. And while I don't think that it holds up on every level of the execution, there are things, obviously, for being a 90-year-old film that just don't sing as well as The Wizard of Oz or Gone with the Wind do even 5 years later, or even Casablanca gets a little bit more of a bump for some of the things it's doing in that film. And maybe you can give that credit in classicness, but fine. But the execution on this, I think it's a little oversimplistic. There are times in the ending that I don't think it works from a production standpoint. The characters are a little thinly drawn, but it's not bad. Again, it's a cute movie, quote unquote. So I have a 7.5.
The pacing was unique. The way it was structured was unique. As you indicated, this was not the first, nor was it the last romantic comedy or screwball comedy. But I think it started a trend with how they were presented and done that lasted for a long time, if not with roots that are existing even to now doing these type of films. So I went just a little higher than you. I went with an 8.
So that's a 7.75 between the two of us. Classicness. I'll let you go first.
Boy, there were some cringy moments where he threatened to slap her and, you know, he's getting fresh on the bus. And I keep drawing a blank as to the Shapely. Getting fresh on the bus. Some of the comments and such, you know, the fact that he beats the guy up and ties him to a tree and steals his car when he tried to do the hitchhiking. There's just some things here that I thought were a little cringy. So starting with our normal 7, I went down a point for those. So I'm at a 6.
I mean, I guess I could see how that bothers you. I didn't quite have the same reaction. I don't think this is particularly ahead of its time necessarily. And I guess I don't find that quite offensive, knowing the context of the time in which it was made. It gives equal weight to both of its leads. Like, neither one of them feels like they're given the advantage in the film. I do think that she is given just as much ability and smarts and creativity during the course of the film, and part of that is the writing. But I also think that she's not given second billing in a film that you really could. Now, most of the film revolves around their relationship and how much they're interacting, so it would be kind of weird if he was the predominant character. But we get a lot of her perspective. We open the movie with her perspective. We see how men are kind of taking advantage of her. And again, within context, she's trying to get out of those situations and do what she wants with her life. So even that, I would give it a little bit of credit. The one drawback I have is a little bit of the overbearing father, where he's a little bit too controlling. But we've seen that through the course of movies, even into the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. It's presented in different ways, and maybe not quite as I have all of these guys hired to be able to like lock you in a boat somewhere so that you can't marry the guy that you want. But again, I think that's an example more where you forgive this a little bit because it's kind of cute, as opposed to being, I guess the word you used was cringy. So for me, there aren't any major markers that hold it back or move it forward. I'd be tempted to say that it would be kind of in the 7 range, but I'll give it an extra half point for a level of timelessness, given that this is 90 years old. So I'm at a 7.5.
Okay.
So that's a 6.75 between the two of us. Rewatchability. This is easy to watch. It's short. I have tried to suggest this to people on multiple occasions. I think this is kind of an underrated Best Picture winner, despite some of its, you know, datedness a little bit, and maybe its over sentimentality and the fact that it's kind of black and white. There's a little bit of overacting. It's one of those that I still think people can find cute if they like good old classic films. You just have to be willing to watch good old classic films, though. And I don't know how many people are necessarily going to want to do that. So I have a 3 that I would likely put it on my own, but I have a 4 that I would probably leave it on. So I have a 7.
I originally had down earlier today a 6. Then I stopped to think about it. I'm already thinking I should finish watching it because your mother watched it with the first half with us, and then we had to stop and pick it up. She couldn't make it the second or when we picked it up again. And actually, I wouldn't mind watching this again, not in the far distant future. So at that point, I'm going to just go with a 7 as well.
So it's a 7 average between the two of us.
Yes. Was that a question?
Well, you kind of left on a hanging note there, so I was just kind of... Yeah, okay.
Not a hanging Chad, right?
No. I don't need to revisit that weird era of politics.
Yeah.
And how different the country might have been. Anyway.
Yeah.
Audience score on this one, we had an 89% for Google users, a 93% for Rotten Tomato users, giving us a 9.1. So to recap the categories, we had a 5.5 for Legacy, a 9.75 for Impact and Significance, a 7.75 for Novelty, a 6.75 for Classicness, Rewatchability was a 7, and a 9.1 for Audience Score, giving us a final total of 45.85. And currently placing it on our list, just outside of our top 100, and tied exactly with Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy.
Oh, the two very similar films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe roughly 69 years apart.
Hmm.
That'll be an interesting tiebreaker.
Yeah. Interesting number.
If you disagree with any of our scores or have any comments for us, anything that you'd like to add when we may revisit or reconsider this at a later date, please write us at greatestalltimemoviepodcast@gmail.com or find us on YouTube, Instagram, X, Letterboxd, TikTok at the handle at Gmote Podcast. That takes us to remaining questions for this one. Do you believe that Peter and Ellie stay married?
Yes.
The only thing that would lead me to believe that they would is the circumstances of the time. Divorce was just not that popular. And so,
correct.
Since this is one of mutual infatuation for a while, I just think they probably stick it out because there's a certain cultural context that adds to this and says to me that they would stay married. I don't know if this was a movie done 90 years later, if that's probably the case. It might be that like they have a fling for several months and then they get tired of each other and realize they're just too different. But I think in this particular case, they do stay married. Do they live the simple lifestyle, or do they eventually inherit all the money and she and he go off as like the heiress to one of the great family fortunes?
I think that's going to be the more interesting storyline. I mean, you could have made a sequel just on that. Them constantly going back and forth as to whether they are going to be living with daddy's money or they're going to be self-sufficient.
Actually, that's a pretty good idea. I could buy into that one. I don't know if it works now, but yeah, I could buy this. At least as a concept. You could probably still make a pseudo sequel where it doesn't involve the same characters, but kind of engages that kind of a premise.
And it has been done to some extent in television with the television show Bewitched and to a lesser extent, I Dream of Jeannie. She has the capability of giving him whatever he wants and him not wanting her to do that.
Do you have any remaining questions?
I do not.
Okay. So we're going to get to a new segment that we teased last week at the end of our second part of the Oscars preview, but we're debuting Ask Dana Anything.
Okay. I don't know if anybody finds this worthwhile, but okay, go ahead.
Our resident Scooby-Doo villain who helps manage our social media, one Mr. Andrew Corns of the Revisionist Almanac, has found a software where you can submit questions anonymously. So I do not know where these questions necessarily came from. Apparently it was one of our many social media followers. So I can't accredit this to anyone specifically because nobody answered in the comments of X or Instagram where this post was seen. They submitted the question via the software. So I have two for you. Do you want the more professional facing one or the more personal facing one first?
I'll give me the professional one to get that out of the way.
Okay. With your background in law, what's the best film representation of accurate legal proceedings?
Oh, boy.
I have an answer to this question.
I have two, but for vastly different reasons. Okay. Legally Blonde, which really does do a decent job of telling you how absolutely horrendous law school is and how bad the professors and fellow students are to each other.
Okay.
Once you can get past that, law school is a breeze. The subject material is tough, but it's the stress associated with this. You know, I have to be number one. If you're not number one, you're nothing. The Ricky Bobby mentality.
You ain't first, you're last.
Yeah. And for the other one, actually, it's a film I just saw. It's called The Judge with Robert Downey Jr. and Robert Duvall. And the reason why is it's set in a small town. You have to deal with small town lawyers, outside prosecutors, judges who are hyper sensitive to their record and who overly manage their courtroom and are kind of dicks about it. I thought it played about as well as being in a rural setting in a courtroom as any legal thriller that I had seen.
I'll throw out another two that I think are pretty good on the legal aspects of it and trying to make it pretty accurate to what trial work is actually like. My Cousin Vinny.
There's another great one, yes.
And Anatomy of a Murder.
Yes. The part where he disappears without paying his fee, I'm way too familiar with.
Well, save that one for when we discuss it later this year.
Yeah.
All right. The second question. What's your proudest moment of Tom as a father? Love the show. So for whoever submitted that you love the show, I appreciate that. I also appreciate the question and putting him on the spot.
There are several.
Interesting.
I will give you a couple. You had some trouble in school, mm-hmm. in a college. Mm-hmm. You fixed the problem, and you graduated without having to have me bail you out or coming just and admitting defeat. And you pulled up your big boy pants and succeeded, which I was very pleased and proud of. Some are more personal, and I'd rather not give them on air.
That's fine. I can understand and appreciate that.
But I think just finally coming to right now, I'm seeing, and your mother and I both have commented about this lately, is when you worked for the firm before, you were rather indifferent to the clients. And we're finding that you have a much more empathetic way about you, and that you've grown and matured just in the time between you worked for the firm before and now back with the firm now. And I'm seeing a lot of growth. I also, what one other comment would make be is your mother kept saying throughout high school that you were the laziest kid she'd ever seen.
Guilty.
I said, just wait, because my parents would say the same thing. And then once I got to a point where I was responsible for stuff, I had no problem motivating myself. And so I see how what you do with the show and with work and all of that, and it makes me happy that you put in the effort and the time and are so dedicated to the stuff. And I thank you, because this show is really a lot about you, not about me, because you do all the heavy lifting, and I wouldn't be doing this but for you. So that in and of itself makes me proud as well.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And again, thank you to whoever put you on the spot with that anonymous question. We have a few that we just answered in our, let's say, Oscars recap show that we did our live stream on. And if I haven't thrown it up on the feed already as its own audio podcast, you can go over to YouTube. Even though it was live streamed at the time, it is in perpetuity on our channel there. So you should be able to find that. We'll have some more of these Ask Dana Anythings as we kind of go along. So if you want to submit any questions, again, greatestalltimemoviepodcast@gmail.com, or find us on YouTube, Instagram, X, Letterboxd, or TikTok at the handle at Gmode Podcast. And I believe you can still find the submission form for the anonymous questions on either our X or Instagram. So that takes us to final thoughts for the week.
Well, I really don't have any. I'm looking forward to, we have two different film festivals. The one's the Wisconsin Film Festival in Madison, and then the Beloit Film Festival. I'm looking forward, and I'm just going to spend some time, even probably tonight after we're done recording here, look at the entries in the film festivals. I always enjoy it. It's one of the ways I can try to take a little bit of time off, and I work during the day if I stay a few days longer in the hotel, and then do the movies at night during the week if I'm going to be there for more than the extended weekend. I'm looking forward to that. I'm thinking there's going to be some pretty good entries.
So just a note of maybe, I don't know, self-pride or whatever it is. It used to be my goal to watch just the nominees for Best Picture, and then I'd maybe do a couple of categories here or there to fill stuff in. But between the ballot project that we were part of for the Revisionist Almanac, where we submitted to their top, I think, five categories, top six categories. It was all the acting ones, director and picture. So yes, top six. And then started kind of just getting an itch to finish all the rest of the films, since they were technically available to me, whether it be the shorts or the international films and such. And before we had recorded our episode, I think I had gotten to roughly like 50 and a half of the films. I've subsequently finished two of the others, and I'm really kind of working on a last minute version of the last one. But I counted, I think it's 53 nominated films, and I somehow finished all of them, or will have finished all of them, by the time that the Oscars will roll around. We're recording this before the Oscars actually happen. But, and then I went and counted because it was asked of me, you got to 36 out of 53 this year. So maybe a hand for yourself a little bit for being a trooper and sticking out a bunch of those. Although, to be fair, we watched a bunch of those while we were sick with COVID and had nothing better to do.
Well, I don't know. I thought I'd actually done a few more than 36, but...
Nope, 36.
Okay.
Because a lot of the categories were crossover from the Best Picture winners this year, or Best Picture nominees, I should say. And then you only have 15 shorts, so there were a lot from that. And then I think between Naiad, Rustin, and The Color Purple, you knocked out most of the major categories. Then you had May, December had one various nomination. And yep. Really, unless you started seeing a lot of the international films, which I think you saw Perfect Days, Teacher's Lounge, and Zone of Interest. So you got to three of those. And you only got to one documentary that I knew of, which was the one you mentioned on the preview, The Eternal Memory. And I counted all of the animation ones for you. Yeah, that's 36. I mean, 36 out of 53, you only didn't get to like 17, where it's Golda and El Conde and, you know, a few of these other weird ones.
I just couldn't do Golda. It just looked so bad.
It was not good. Like, I can understand the makeup nomination, but that was a slog.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you got through quite a bit. So I got to give you a little bit of a hand for, you know, not necessarily getting to everything. And at one point you had stated, I'm going to get to everything. And I'm like, yeah, it's going to be a lot for me to get to everything. And you get tired and have a few more things on your plate on given weeks than I do.
Yeah. School board and work. And yeah.
Well, also yourself. I guess, requirement that many times you limit yourself by what mood you're in sometimes. I don't have quite the same issue. There are times where I'm like, I just don't want to sit through, you know, a 2-hour German slog fest. But there are other times where most times that doesn't bother me. I can turn on just about anything and be appreciative of it and not have to worry about the subject material. Maybe it's because I'm becoming slowly more dead inside, but still.
Well, and I just, somebody was asking me when I was referring to this, but when I was a kid, there used to be a guy who was a regular guest on the Ed Sullivan Show. So if you're an old fart like me,
I was going to say, you're really dating yourself right now.
Yeah. Well, I was a kid, you know, like 6-7 years old, but the guy would come out and he had bamboo poles and then he would start spinning plates. And he would spin 25, 30 plates, and he'd go from one bamboo pole to bamboo pole, keeping all those plates spinning. And a lot of my life is like spinning plates. And so there are certain days where it's nothing but spinning plates. And sometimes by the time I get home, sitting down and watching, even though as much as I enjoy movies, even watching a movie where I might have to think or have to react or have emotion is just not there. I've been doing too much and things have been going too hectic. Sometimes just sitting with some silence is a nice thing. And so when I'm talking about those days that I'm just not in the mood, those are usually those days. And I usually have one of those a week. And so it just cut into the time available to get everything done.
So thank you all for being with us again this week. Thank you to all the people who submitted questions. That'll do it for us this week. Thank you for listening. I still believe, in spite of everything, that people are really good at heart. Next week, for our 204th episode, we discuss The Diary of Anne Frank from 1959, celebrating its 65th anniversary, directed by George Stevens, written by Francis Goodrich and Albert Hackett. Starring Millie Perkins, Joseph Schildkraut, Richard Boehmer, and Shelley Winters. You won't want to miss that one, so watch ahead of the show by searching the Real Good app to find where it's streaming for you. That's R-E-E-L-G-O-O-D. Please like, follow, rate, and review, or whatever on whichever platform you have so that more can join in our fun. You can also email the show at thenewRonnieDuncanStudios.com or at greatestalltimemoviepodcast@gmail.com. Find us on YouTube, X, Instagram, Letterboxd, or TikTok at the handle at Cheapload Podcast. The Greatest Movie of All Time is a production of Ronnie Duncan Studios. Our show is mixed, edited, and written by Thomas Duncan. Our music is thanks to Purple Planet Music. Our technical provider and distributor is Captivate FM.